Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everyone.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. So it's a regularly scheduled weekly episode. Today we're going to be talking about one game. We're going to talk about how to play it. We're going to talk about how to win. And we're going to talk about how it was designed.
Right, yeah.
And to be technical, it's not necessarily a board game, but we are talking about a card game today.
Right.
So Matthew, what are we talking about?
We are talking about Keyforge, designed by Richard Garfield and published by Fantasy Flight Games in 2018. And do want to give sort of a quick disclaimer. This is more of like a first impressions.
Mm-hmm.
As it is with competitive card games, they kind of are built around having a very, very high skill ceiling, as well as a very wide design space. So this is like our interpretation of the game based on what we've played of it.
Right. Although maybe it's fair to say that this kind of game, the first time you play it, is much closer to an experienced level of play than, say, a different game like Magic.
Right.
We'll understand. Yeah. You'll understand why in a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Let's go right into the how to play.
Sure. Okay. So for a short description of what Keyforge is all about, in Keyforge, players pilot unique procedurally generated 36 card decks filled with creatures, artifacts, actions, and enhancements from three different factions. Their goal is to control the board and collect amber. At the beginning of a player's turn, they choose one of their factions, and for the rest of that turn, they may only play and activate cards from that faction. When a creature activates, its controller chooses whether it fights an opponent's creature, uses a unique activated ability, or collects amber by reaping. At the beginning of a player's turn, if they have six or more amber collected, they forge one key. After a player forges their third key, they win the game. So that is the basic description of what Keyforge is all about. So now we're going to get a little bit deeper into how the game is played, and we're going to talk about strategy.
Right, yeah.
So
let's see. Let's start with the houses.
Yeah.
Right. So each Keyforge deck will come with cards from three of the seven houses in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And each house has sort of its own identity to it, both thematically and mechanically. So like the Sanctum house, it seems pretty based around like a lot of board presence with like a lot of creatures, for example. Mm-hmm. Or the Shadows house has a lot of evasive creatures that are hard to get rid of.
Logo's house has a lot to deal with card draw.
Yeah. And efficiency and like combos. So like figuring out how the houses work is step one to figuring out how the decks work. Because in general, if you look at a deck and you see like it's these three houses, you'll probably have some idea of how to play it. Like a deck with Sanctum and Untamed is probably pretty aggro heavy, pretty creature heavy.
Right.
Whereas a deck with Mars and Diz, I believe it is probably more control board wipe heavy.
Mm-hmm. So like we said at the beginning, these decks are procedurally generated. So a algorithm is selecting which three factions are going to be in any given deck and which cards from those factions are going to be in that deck. And those cards all get packaged and shipped. And when you purchase the deck, that deck will have its predetermined deck list printed on one of the cards in the deck. And for as long as you own that deck, that is the way that deck will be made up. Like you don't do any deck building in this game.
The card backs are also procedurally generated to show the three houses and then a unique sort of image and name for the deck.
Right. I believe the name for the deck is the Archon.
Right.
I think that the deck is sort of identified by.
Yeah.
And I think when you play the deck thematically, you are that Archon.
Right. You're like an overlord that is controlling and manipulating the three houses in your deck.
Right. So the name of the deck, the card back of the deck and all of the cards in the deck are all procedurally generated by an algorithm. And I assume that this algorithm, I think I read somewhere that it's trying to make a deck that has synergies built into it.
Yeah.
And is also relatively as strong as any other randomly given deck, at least as close as it can get it. Now, that's not a perfect thing, that last point, because there are clearly going to be decks that are stronger than other decks out of the box.
There is a way to circumvent that, though.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a second, but there's a couple other things I want to talk about. First of all, I want to say that my deck that I bought ended up being Sanctum, which, like we said, is lots of knights and board control, very strong and durable creatures. Logos, which has a lot to do with card advantage and card draw. And then my third faction was Dis, which had... It seemed like a faction that had a lot of sacrifices in addition to playing their cards. Like, they had cards that were strong but required you to make sacrifices, like add chain, which is the mechanic that we'll talk about in a little bit. But it also had a little bit of recursion to it.
Right, yeah. And then you can talk the deck that I got was Sanctum and Shadows and Mars. And Mars, I didn't mention earlier, but it had a lot of board wipes that hit every creature. And then the Mars creatures themselves were kind of lacking. Like, I didn't have as many as I did the other two factions. But in turn, I had a lot more Mars actions that were impactful. Mm-hmm. And my deck ended up being more of like a control-y deck, where I tried to use the board wipes from Mars to kill off Jeffrey's creatures and then play my Sanctum creatures that stuck around for a while.
Right.
I was gonna say, you mentioned that every turn you can only use cards from one faction, right? Yeah.
It should also be mentioned that these decks, they're 36 card decks, but the spread of cards from each faction is not perfectly split evenly.
I'm not sure. And I don't have, I have one deck handy, so I guess
actually,
I can check.
No, it is.
Oh, it is?
At least in my deck, it is an even split. There's 12 cards from every faction.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see. Some other like basic rule stuff that we should probably mention. Mm-hmm. Is that at the end of your turn, you draw up to 6 cards at hand.
Mm-hmm.
On the first turn of the game, you can, if you're the first player, you can only play one card. But you do start with an extra card in hand as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We should probably also mention how combat works.
Right. So there is permadamage in this game. So when damage is inflicted to a creature, it stays on that creature until it either gets healed or that creature dies. And when you fight another creature, so fighting another creature is one of the things that you can do with your own creatures when you activate it. Activating a creature is turning it sideways. It's like tapping in Magic, if you're familiar with Magic. So you activate a creature, you choose to fight an opponent's creature, and both creatures will deal their power simultaneously to the other creature. And once a creature has has taken damage equal to their power or greater than their power, then they die.
Right.
So your power is both the amount of damage you deal as well as the amount of damage you take before you die.
Right. There is.
There's a couple different defensive abilities, and I think one of the more common ones is armor.
Right.
And armor just says that if you would take damage, you reduce the first X amount of damage that you take in a turn. So if you have 2 armor and you fight a creature that has 4 power, you'll only take 2 damage from that creature. But if you were somehow attacked by another creature on the same turn, then that creature would deal full damage to you. It wouldn't get reduced.
Right, yeah.
A couple other keywords. But you had 2 different keywords in your deck, Matthew, that were kind of opposites of each other. One of them was the first time that your creature would take damage while defending. they ignore that damage. Yeah. And you had another one that was basically the opposite, that just said the first time they would take damage when they attack, or right. they take no damage from attacking, something like that.
Right, yeah. And then there were a few cards that also would stun creatures, which mm-hmm. means that the next time you use them, you just remove the stun instead of doing any other action.
Right.
Right.
Okay, so yeah. Should we talk a little more about strategy?
Yeah, let's go into that.
Okay, so this game reminds me, the strategy in this game reminds me a lot of it reminds me a lot of Hearthstone.
Yeah.
So for those who aren't familiar with Hearthstone, it's another game with permadamage on creatures. But instead of trying to collect amber and forge keys, you're just attacking your opponent's life points with your creatures.
Right.
And both games, essentially the way that they work is that you can either use a creature to control the board, which means destroying your opponent's creatures, or you can use a creature to go towards the win condition, right. which is either attacking your opponent's face or getting amber in this game. Like, because that functionality is essentially the same in both of these games, then I think a lot of the strategies carry over between the two. And the main one is just the idea of having board control.
Yeah. This is something in a lot of competitive card games, actually, and just a lot of games in general.
Yeah.
Is that you want to be setting up your own like engine while also just shutting down your opponent's engine.
Right.
And
I just think that, like, you could say that Magic also has an element of board control, but there's so many different ways to play the game,
right,
regardless
yeah.
of board control.
The main axis this game functions on is with creatures and therefore yes. board.
Right.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
to give a description of what that means is that you just want to be both ahead on board and progressing towards the win condition. And so that just means having more creatures than your opponent does on board, or being able to control the amount of creatures your opponent has on board and come out with more creatures so that you can be keeping your opponent from approaching their win condition while slowly approaching yours.
Right, yeah. Because if you have two creatures and your opponent has one, you can attack with one of your creatures and then use the other to get an amber, and you're one amber ahead of the opponent that way. If you do that every turn, then it starts to build up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Obtaining board control, it starts from the first turn and your opening hand. So because board control is such an important axis, I have it here that you want to make sure that your opening hand has as many creatures from one faction as possible so that you can play them all at once and establish board control.
Yeah.
If you have at least like three, I think three is probably the best case scenario that you can hope for consistently.
Yeah.
If you have three creatures from one faction, then that's a pretty good opening hand, because that can control the board, at least if you're going second. I mean, even if you're going first, you can play the one creature on the first turn and then the other two the next turn.
Right. And even in then, you can technically have multiple creatures from different houses, but the idea is that you want to be able to use all of your creatures as often as possible. So mm-hmm. having multiples of the same house means that you can name the same house every turn and use the creatures every turn.
Right. But yeah. that's probably, being able to just name the same house over and over again is probably not something that'll happen very often, because you're going to be playing these cards and then activating them. But then eventually either your creatures from that house are going to die on board because of the damage just piling up. And you're going to run out of cards in hand because you're going to be playing the cards from that faction, but you're not necessarily going to be drawing more cards from that faction.
Right.
So eventually you will have to pick another faction. I think it's reasonable to say, like, you're going to try and get an opening hand with like three creatures from one faction so you can establish board control. Then off of that board control, you want to probably have like one turn where you choose a different faction and play three more creatures from that faction. Right. And at that point, you're in a very solid position.
Right, you want to be able to pivot between factions based on how you can impact the board with them. So you don't switch factions until you're ready to start, like, putting creatures out or removing a lot of your opponent's creatures. And then from there you go on.
Now we're talking about opening hand, and there are mulligans in this game. So this is sort of just where I say you should take your mulligan to try and get that good opening hand, especially because the way that this game works is at the end of your turn, you draw up to six cards. So if you take a mulligan, as long as you're not mulling down to like two or one card, mulligans aren't very impactful in this game.
Oh, and speaking of drawing up to cards, we forgot to actually explain chains.
So let's talk about chains.
Right. So really quick, chains are the built-in handicap system that some cards also interact with. It is where, based on the number of chains you have, you draw up to fewer cards in hand. So if you have 1 to 6 chains, you'll draw up to 5 cards in hand. So less than one of your max hand size. Or not really max hand size, but yeah. If you have 7 to 12, then it is draw up to 4, which is 6 minus 2. And then 13 to... What would that be? 18?
18.
It is draw up to 3, which is 6 minus 3. And then the last bracket is 19 to 24, which is draw up to 2.
Right. So the more chains you have, or at these increments of 6, you will draw one less card.
Right.
Chains. Now, every time you draw a hand and it is impacted by chains, so every time you would draw 6 but you instead draw 5 from your chains, then you shed one chain.
Yeah.
So eventually you will go back down to 0 chains and you will be back at your normal hand size.
Right. But so the method that this can act as a handicap is you can just start with chains if your opponent's deck is too powerful.
Right. If after you've played a couple times with your decks, you realize that one deck is winning significantly more than the other, then you can negotiate starting with chains.
Yeah.
Like you can say, I mean, starting with one chain isn't a huge deal because it's just going to affect the opponent's opening hand and then they're going to shed the chain. So I think usually it's something like 3 chains is probably the minimum where you 2 or 3, maybe 3 chains is probably the minimum where you want to start looking at handicaps for them to actually be a thing. Now, chains are also used in competitive play. They detail this on their website, the Keyforge website, how chains are used competitively, because I was curious. There's no rules that state like any guidelines for how many chains should be given to a player. So in competitive, chains are used as a bidding resource to obtain decks. So they detail 2 different kinds of play. Or sorry, there's more than 2. I didn't see you could scroll. Okay, so adaptive play is each player brings 1 deck to a tournament, and you play in a best of 3 where in game 1 you use your own deck, your opponent uses their deck. In game 2 you switch decks and play with your opponent's deck. And if that goes to a game 3, then that means 1 deck won both games. And so players will bid chains to use the winning deck.
Yeah.
There's another version called auction where it's a sealed format. Every player receives and opens a new deck at the start of the tournament, and lays out all the cards. And then all the players participating will bid chains to take one of those decks and use it for the rest of the tournament.
Neat. Yeah.
So these are just examples of how chains are used to impact the game and to balance things in the game
competitively. And there are cards in the game, like I said, that will just say like you gain 2 chains as part of playing the card. So it's used to balance out some stronger cards as well.
Right.
Yeah. Going back to strategy, by the way. I don't think it's worth it to choose a house just to play actions unless those actions impact the board.
Right.
Or
because board control is key.
Yeah. Or if playing them sets your opponent back by a significant amount of resources like amber. Because I had a card that would like steal 2 of the opponent's amber, and it was an action, but playing it let me sort of gain another turn before Jeffrey would win.
Right. You could think of it like you want to set back your opponent a number of amber equal to the number of creatures they have, or the most number of creatures they have from one faction. Because if you have no creatures on the board, then the only thing their creatures can do is likely just reap amber. And so if you're setting them back that much amber, then their next turn is basically wasted. They get to play some new cards, but amber wise, they won't be ahead.
Yeah. I don't have a whole lot else for strategy at the moment.
So I have one thing.
I do have one more thing, actually.
I have one thing regarding when you forge your second key. So in Hearthstone, this would be changing your objective from controlling the board to going for face and going for the victory, taking out your opponent's life. In Keyforge, there's a point where you can shift from controlling the board and controlling your opponent's creatures to just collecting as much amber as you can to forge your third key. And I think that I think I could say that this moment in the game usually happens if you can forge your second key at least two turns before your opponent can forge theirs.
Right, yeah.
And that just means that you have the tempo advantage going into the third key. And when you're going into the third key, it shifts the balance of what people are trying to do, because all you're trying to do is get to your third key, and your opponent, the only thing your opponent can do is try to stop you.
Yeah.
Because you're approaching the win condition.
Right.
And they can't do other things.
Right. Since you can only forge one key per turn, even if they got 12 amber in one turn after you forge your second key, they would still have to wait another turn and give you another turn, therefore, before forging their third key. So, yeah.
I'm just saying you want to do it before, like, two turns before your opponent forges their second key.
Right. I'm agreeing with you. This is another reason why.
Yeah, even if they get a huge turn, yeah, you'll be... But they probably won't, because, like, if they spent a turn just getting a bunch of amber, that means they're not spending a turn stopping you from getting
enough amber. Yeah, and I'm saying that's why you wouldn't gain amber if you were behind like that.
Sure. Just being ahead that one key makes a huge difference.
I was going to say, so you can discard cards you don't want to play if they're of the faction that you're currently using. So, if there's a card that you think, like, might be good in your current faction, but, you have a lot of other cards of another faction that you might want to pivot to, just discard your current one, even if it's, like, it might be good a turn later, just because having more cards of the next faction you're going to pivot to means that you'll have a better board when you do pivot.
Right. So, this is something that... I have written down that you holding cards in your hand is bad.
Yeah.
You want to be playing or utilizing every card from the faction you chose on the turn that you choose it. Just because that's how you get the most value and the most tempo in this game.
Right.
That's how you get the most effective turns, is by utilizing every card from a faction that you name. So there's some cards in this game that will get stronger as the game progresses. For example, I had a card in my deck that said, when you play him, you get an amber for every key your opponent has forged. And at some games, I would keep those in my hand a little bit before Matthew was about to forge his first key, because I'd be like, oh, these are about to activate. Even if I had already chosen Logos as the faction for my turn, I would hold them in my hand because I'm like, oh, next turn, they're going to be worth amber. But that ended up being way too slow.
Yeah.
It's way better just to discard those cards instead of waiting around for them to be useful. Just discard them and get more cards that could actually be useful the next turn.
Right. When you run out of cards in your deck. Yeah. Oh, yeah. When you run out of cards in your deck, you shuffle your discard pile back into your deck. And so this has sort of the similar... concept behind like deck builders, which is just cycling through your deck and shuffling back and just drawing more cards, typically is very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A similar effect is I had some cards in my deck that they would deal damage or destroy my opponent's creatures based on their position. And this game, position is important for certain effects and abilities. The position meaning that in an opponent's lineup of creatures, you're playing them in a row next to each other, much like any other, you know, card game with creatures. You kind of play them all sitting next to each other. But you can only play a creature on the end of the row, on either end. And those creatures on the ends are called being on the flank. And the creatures in between them are creatures that are non-flanking. Yeah. And I had cards that would target creatures based on whether they were on the flank or non-flanking. Like I had a card that said, like, deal 5 damage to a non-flanking creature.
Exactly.
Those cards early on in the game were very bad because there was never enough creatures on the board for me to target like a non-flanking creature. Like you would only have one or two creatures early on in the game. And I would hold on to those because that's like powerful single target removal. But by the time that I could use it, you already had significant board control over me and there was just nothing I could do because I wasn't playing other cards. So discarding those cards is also a very good thing in this game.
Right.
I guess the last thing I could say is that there's ways to, now we're pretty inexperienced at the game. We've only played it a handful of times with just 2 decks. But it seems to me that you can kind of evaluate cards just based on how many cards they can trade for. And that's the same thing in lots of other card games.
Yeah.
So like board wipes are very powerful because they trade for multiple cards, and cards with armor and high attack are very powerful because they trade for multiple cards on board.
Right. Yeah.
That will give you a board advantage.
Yeah. In many card games, these will be like 2-for-1s or 3-for-1s or stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you always want to have an equal or better rate than 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the rule of thumb. Yeah.
All right. So shall we talk about how it was designed?
Yes. So I want to give a quick recommendation real quick. Richard Garfield actually did an interview with another podcast called The Spelunky Show Like. And that's a really good episode for a podcast if you're interested more in Garfield's himself's thoughts on the game. But he did give some history behind the game's design that I want to go ahead and mention first off.
Okay.
That being that, so, you know, Richard Garfield designed Magic the Gathering for Wizards of the Coast, and he really liked a style of play that was present in early Magic, but not really viable in today's Magic ecosystem. That being Magic Leagues, where players would bring the same deck to a store for many weeks at a time, and it would be less about making minute changes to the metagame or to your deck based on the metagame every week. More so, it would be about just learning to outplay your opponents based on their play habits and the contents of their decks, which you would eventually learn as well as your own. He liked that idea, but obviously, like I said, you know, in today's day and age, it wouldn't quite work as well. And eventually people started to drift away because trading got more popular and, you know, people could make more decks and try more things and all that. But so he had this idea of a card game where you buy a completely new deck and you're the only one that has that deck. And you never edit it or switch out cards or anything, but the printing technology just hasn't been there until like last year or the year before when the game started going into production. And to give an example or to give like a idea of this, most of the time to like cost effectively print a card game, you have to print large sheets of cards at once. And switching out card backs and sorting them even can just add on more and more costs. So only recently has there been like a machine that's been able to use this level of precision and, a company able to fund this amount of customization on the backs of the cards as well.
So now we have KeyForge.
Right. Yeah. So. You Let's see. I'm trying to go through my notes here.
I'll start with one topic in the design discussion, and that this game has no instant effects to it. Instant effects referring to the cards in Magic that you can play on your opponent's turn. There's nothing in this game that you can do during your opponent's turn. And there's very few abilities that will trigger or activate on your opponent's turn. The only one that I can think of is Capturing, which is a effect that will take your opponent's amber, place it on your own creature, and when that creature dies, you put that amber into your amber pool.
There's other death triggers.
There's other death triggers. Okay. So all those death triggers, they can happen on your opponent's turn, but nothing else really happens on your opponent's turn from your side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't like have to gain priority or, you know, play a card.
Right. So what this does is it simplifies the rules
a lot.
But it also works very well with the whole drawing up to six cards mechanic in this game, because essentially while you're waiting for your opponent to take their turn, you have all of the information available for the resources that you're going to have on your next turn. And so you can just spend that time planning for your next turn. Right, your opponent might get rid of some of your creatures, but they might force you to discard some cards, but usually you're going to be able to have all the information you're going to have available to you for your next turn available to you during your opponent's turn.
Right.
So those two things kind of work nicely so that you're not experiencing entirely too much downtime.
Right. And death triggers being like the main thing to happen on your opponent's turn, it still works because you know, you're manipulating the card anyway, so it's less mm-hmm. likely that you're going to forget about it. You know, it's not like something that you have to remove counters from that's off to the side or something. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, you're already picking up the card. So, yeah, there is like a way to bring it to mind, like, hey, this thing is doing something.
Mm-hmm.
This also does have the benefit of working better in a digital space, which is becoming more of like a thing. I don't know how much of a thing it is for Keyforge, but it's interesting to note that. That's why like Hearthstone doesn't do it as much either.
Right. It always gets a little clunky when instant speed effects are a thing. And if anything, there's the whole giveaway of it. Like if you're trying to keep an instant speed effect hidden, but the game has to give you the chance to use it. So, sometimes it just kind of gives it away for you because it's like, hey, do you want to use that thing? And you're like, right. What thing?
Yeah.
I don't want my opponent to know that I have a thing.
But as a physical game, yeah, it does work because you are drawing so many cards every turn, like you said. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a bit, for one thing, about how the procedural generation works, but also sort of just the concept of, like, classes or archetypes in card games.
Mm-hmm.
So I use class because this is more of, like, in the programming sense of a class, but this could also be like colors in Magic or Pokemon types in Pokemon, or of course mm-hmm. classes in Hearthstone. This is something I've touched on before in episodes, but a lot of competitive card games will have these like divisions of cards and whatnot to limit what you can play in the deck so that like you're not just playing all of the best cards because they're the best and it prevents them from getting homogenized.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Keyforge wouldn't technically need this just based on the printing method alone, because all the decks are randomized. But one thing that this does do is it makes a really easy to understand resource system that's still pretty flexible. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not like gaining resources every turn that you're not. It's not like Hearthstone where you're gaining a mana automatically. It's not Magic where you have to play a card, or Netrunner where you have to do an action. The resources are just you choose one house to play and then you play as many as you want, which does allow you to play a lot of cards, which can be very fun as like just a general thing that's fun to do. I might have said this before, but like primal fun feelings of like drawing a lot of cards and playing a lot of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And we mentioned how it still works as like a very important decision making decision element, a challenge.
Oh, another thing that the factions in Keyforge do and how they function is they sort of mitigate the strength of card advantage in this game.
Yeah.
Because any given card that you draw has just a 1 in 3 chance of actually being useful the turn that you draw it or the next turn.
Right.
It's card advantages is still a thing in this game. But it's I just think it's slightly less so because of the faction system.
Right.
It's interesting.
Additionally, not only does it still have the like identity and thematic relevance that classes and other games have, but like I said at the start of this episode or near the start, it does let you sort of guess and predict what a deck might play like based on the factions alone. So there is an element of legibility to those factions. Like you can go to a tournament and be like, oh, like I said, like this deck has Logos and Diz, so it's probably pretty like synergy combo heavy. Or this card Sanctum, so or this deck Sanctum
Mars.
Yeah, so it has a lot of board. Yeah. And having that quick legibility is really useful for competitive games, especially where you can go to a tournament with, you know, X number of people, and for each magnitude of X, you still want it to be pretty legible so that at, you know, only until you get to like the thousands does it start to become tricky to manage.
Right.
The
built-in handicap system is also super smart and elegant, though I wish that there were more clear ways of understanding how to like utilize the handicap system.
Yeah, like a frame of reference or guideline.
Right. I think so. From what I can tell, the only way of knowing what kind of handicap you should use against an opponent is just by playing them a bunch and figuring out how your decks stack up against each other. And then implementing and testing chains and handicaps until you reach a more equal state.
So there is an app for this game, and every deckless card that comes with every deck has a QR code you scan.
Okay.
And I think this might have something to help you like determine how many chains you should use. Okay. I know for organized play, it can help log results. I'm not too familiar with it, though, and it's honestly something we probably should have checked before we did this episode. Sorry.
I mean, this is our just beginner's take on the game, I guess.
Yeah.
From two folks that play a lot of competitive card games.
Right. Let's see. I also like the thing about the chains is I think I've seen people like kind of complain about like balance band-aids. Like I've seen the opinion that ban lists in card games are kind of like a very sloppy solution to poor design, which I understand why people would say that. But with chains, it is kind of nice because it is a part of the mechanics as well as a handicap or, you know, a balancing method. It's a resource you use in competitive play. It's a thing that cards interact with directly in a game, so it doesn't feel so separate from the design. It's like baked into it already, infused. Yeah.
I don't think I have much else to talk about.
So something that's an interesting consequence of the procedural generation is that theoretically, because of the procedural generation making decks, it shouldn't be impossible to add more houses to the game. So this is just like speculation slash like, you know, just trying to look at things a certain way. But so one problem as far as like adding more classes into other games, like more colors in Magic or more classes in Hearthstone, is that there is such a wide card pool already for the existing ones that to add the amount of flexibility and relevance to the new stuff, it takes a lot of work. And you probably won't be able to reach that amount of flexibility and variety for, you know, quite a while.
Right.
You know, like, why would you build a deck with this new thing when the existing classes have years worth of history and options available to you, including all these really strong options?
Right. Like, if, to use Magic as an example, if they were to add a sixth color, there's already so many cards that have multiple color combinations for all the other five that it would have made sense to use the six. Like, you'd still be using two or three color combinations from the existing five for, right, for forever, since you there's so many multicolor useful cards in those colors, and those colors are so deep, you know, themselves, right, to have very powerful cards.
Yeah, if you'd think of, like, each class has like 5 to 10 really strong cards every set, by the time you release a new class, you already have to deal with, you know, upwards of 25, 50, however many existing really strong cards, which ends up being an entire deck. Anyways, Keyforge, since it's procedurally generated, they don't really have to worry about that because the deck is self-contained. And from what I understand, there aren't any direct hosers, like cards that will directly say, like, if your opponent has a Logos house card, you know, there are things where, like, you name a house and your opponent does something for all cards of that house. However, again, those are self-contained because you can still name one of the new houses in that example. Whether or not that like feature creep and world creep is a thing that will happen, you know, I have no idea. But it is an interesting consequence, like I said, of preventing players from deck building.
Right. It is a design space that emerges from this design decision.
Right. Just to kind of wrap things up, I guess, since you didn't have much else, I do think Keyforge is a really interesting window into the future of the industry as a whole.
Right.
I mean, because Keyforge is not only... it's very heavily reliant on technology. You know, the printing methods are brand new and very few other games have even used them. Fantasy Flight has a cooperative game with a similar printing style of, like, unique experiences, unique content for every player. And then app integration to help, like, balance certain things, or like I said, I haven't played with it, but just if it is able to keep track of those types of things, like, I don't know, I think that's really interesting. Like, it just shows where we are as an industry today and what you can mess with and explore now. Like, you know, I hope more procedurally generated games in some degree start to appear, because that's a really cool idea to have, like, a game or part of a game that's completely unique to you. You know, it's personal.
Yeah. I mean, personally, before I played Keyforge, I was speculative of how the effect of not being able to build a deck would be on me and my enjoyment of the game. But after having played it, I think I could say that, like, it doesn't bother me at all, at least for this first experience that I've had. Decks are also only $10 to buy.
Yeah, pretty affordable. You know,
it's super, I mean, super affordable, like, yeah. with the secondary market the way it is in other, like, paper-based trading card games, collectible card games, like, $10 isn't even enough to buy a single card if you want to be relevant in competitions.
Yeah, it's neat.
Yeah, all right. So, very cool. Okay, so I think that will be the end of our episode on Keyforge, so thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, to find other episodes. We have everything tagged, so if you're looking for our discussion on a game that you enjoy, you can find it there. If you don't find it there, you can hit us up on social media and give us a recommendation. We love to test out the games that our listeners recommend. You can find a link to our TeePublic store on our website, or you can go to teepublic.com/user/bgbcast, where we have merch with our cool logo on it. We have t-shirts. If you want to get our logo on something else, hit us up and we'll put it up on our store. You can follow us, leave comments and ratings on any podcasting platform if you so choose. And I believe that'll do it for BG Bros Plugs. So let's hand it over to Matt Plugs.
I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/twak. I stream usually weekdays from 11 a.m. Central Time to about 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time. I play a lot of different video games, exploration games, roguelites, fighting games, competitive games, platformers, what have you. A lot of indie games. And I also speedrun a few things. And through that Twitch chat, you can also find a Discord server for fans of the stream and the podcast, where you can chat to people that watch the stream and listen to the podcast, and us as well. And I also write articles for the BGBcast website under the Episodes and Articles tab. My most recent article was about Enter the Gungeon and its combination of theme and mechanics. And I have not written anything quite recently. I have been in the middle of writing a very long analysis of the video game The Witness, but I will try to pepper in some other shorter articles here and there. So check that, you know, every so often to see if there's something new.
All right, that does it for Matt Plugs, and that does it for our episode. We will see you next week, and thank you for listening.
See ya.